Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 47. My name is John. Should 5% appear too small, be thankful I don't take it all. I give a lot of hell to collectives, and even though I've said this before, I want to make my position perfectly clear. I think collectives could work. Seriously. Here's how. Small groups of people getting together with a common ideal can work. If you and a couple of your close friends want to get together, buy some land, cultivate it, and share in the harvest, you could probably make it work. Why? Because you can all agree on how to work together. You can develop checks and balances with each other and make sure everyone stays on the same page. But that's not how collectives operate. What happens is a group of people gets together with a common ideal. They find out that it works for them, and it makes them happy. So they say to themselves, "Hey, this is great for us, so it must be great for everyone." And then they proceed to influence authority or even take power themselves and force people to conform to their ideology. And that is where I have the problem with collectives. That's where they lose me. As long as you keep it voluntary, I'll support you. Once you force me, or anyone, to go along with your plan, no matter how good it may be, I'm done with you. If this podcast is sounding vaguely familiar, it's because most of it, so far, is a repeat of the opening of the last podcast. There's a lot of collectives out there who have crossed the line from being a group that thinks it has a good idea and wants you to join, to a group that is convinced their ideas are superior and want to make you go along with them, no matter what. Last month, I talked about the ever more frustrating neoconservative religious collective and their crusade against homosexuality. I chose them for two reasons. One, because the month of December was chock full of their antics. But it was also a good opportunity to show conservatives and Republicans that they are just as bad as their liberal Democratic counterparts. And this is just one example of their herd mentality. As I stated before, the Democrats and the Republicans are two sides of the same coin. Flipping the coin merely reveals where the parties are going to kick you next. Flip its heads, they'll kick you in the head. Flip its tails, they'll kick your ass. The major political parties in the United States are little more than schoolyard bullies who use their legislation to intimidate you until you say uncle. There are plenty of collectives, though. And the one that inspired this month's podcast can't really be defined as siding with one political party or another. You can't really define them as liberal or conservative, because I've heard both sides advocate for the collective. Most people are part of it and think those who aren't are kooks. But they are only a part of it because they think that's the only way there is. They are the OPM collective. As some of you may know, OPM stands for Other People's Money. Which also happens to be the title of a fine little obscure Danny DeVito movie from back in the early 90s. Check it out if you ever get the chance, especially his rebuttal speech near the end of the movie. We in the United States are now beginning the second century of a system that tells us that the federal government has the right to take a percentage of our earnings. 100 years. That means the World War I generation, World War II generation, the baby boomers, Generation X, the millennials, and a generation making its way into the first few grades of school now. Basically, 5 generations have lived under the idea that the federal government can take whatever percentage of earnings they deem necessary. When the Soviet Union, for lack of a better word, fell, the oldest people there didn't like it because communism was all they knew. Everything else was alien and scary. Similarly, the citizens of the United States are so used to the idea of government taking from their incomes in order to function that the idea that there is another way, that there once was another way, is strange and silly. But it's not just enough that the federal government is taking people's earnings. They also do it in kind of a sneaky way. For most people, the federal government takes it out of their paychecks before they even see it. Then, if the government takes more than their determined percentage, they give some of it back, and the people are supposed to be happy about it. Some people believe that the best thing to do to get people to understand what the government takes from them is to do away with the withholdings. Give people the entire amount they've earned and make them pay the government at the end of the year, and you can damn well bet a lot of people would then be for lower taxes. But how did we get here? How did we become a nation where taking your earnings is now the natural expectation? There's a long history to the personal income tax, which actually reared its ugly head during the Civil War, but it went away. Proof that it can be made to go away. But rather than get into that relatively short period of tax history, I'm going to focus on the change that came about 101 years ago. Prior to the 16th Amendment, if you wanted to have an income tax on the citizens, it had to be, as the Constitution put it, in proportion to the census. So if, say, the state of New York had 10% of the United States population, no more than 10% of the total taxes collected could come from New York. So what happens if you have a high population, but an overall low individual income in your state? Conversely, what if you had a low population, but an overall high individual income? There could be some unfairness there. Of course, one state doesn't want another state to be given an unfair advantage, or bear more of the tax burden. So the state legislatures would elect senators who would go to Washington, D.C. to make sure the federal government didn't pilfer the state's rights. Oh yeah, in 1913 another change was made. The Constitution was changed regarding how senators are elected, because prior to that, they were elected by the state's legislatures. But things were brewing on the horizon as the second decade of the 1900s began. The temperance movement was nearing its decades-long goal to ban alcohol in the United States. Ah, but 40% of the taxes collected by the federal government prior to 1913 came from alcohol. So that would take away a huge amount of federal revenue. The federal government would need something to take the place of that revenue when the temperance movement got their dream of a nationwide alcohol ban to become reality. That's going to happen in 1917. The Republican Party had put forth two progressive presidents, Teddy Roosevelt in the prior decade, and as the second decade was beginning, William Howard Taft. And most people would say that Teddy was the worst of the two when it comes to constitution-eroding policies. But Taft puts up a pretty good fight. During Taft's presidency, he advocated an income tax on corporations as part of the privilege of doing business. It was during his administration that Congress got the ball rolling on what would become the 16th and 17th Amendments. These two amendments would forever alter our nation and break the ground for the bureaucratic apparatus lording over us today. One gave power to the federal government to impose an income tax however they see fit, no longer having to be in proportion to the census. The other conveniently transferred the election of senators from the state legislatures to the general population of each state, neutering the state legislature's ability to restrain the federal government. The Democratic Party would take the miserable progressive policies of the previous Republican administrations to whole new levels. Progressive collectivist, professional academic, and racist Woodrow Wilson, the man who stated, "Remember that God ordained that I should be the next president of the United States. Neither you nor any other mortal or mortals could have prevented that." That man had plans. He had intellectual, scholarly, philosophical, bookwormy plans. And those plans did not include that burdensome United States Constitution. He would lay the foundation for a fundamental change in the United States. Those who do not learn from history are indeed doomed to repeat it. The 16th Amendment was enacted in February of 1913. By October of that same year, the income tax was put into place. It's amazing how quickly the government will move once they can get their hands into people's pockets. It's almost like they already had an apparatus in place to take advantage of the coming taxation. Once the tax was in place, if you earned $3,000 a year or more, you would have to pay 1% in taxes. If you made over $500,000 a year, you were then charged an additional 6%. Why would they tax somebody who was making so little money? You're thinking in 21st century terms. If you adjust it for inflation, the $3,000 becomes approximately $71,000, and the $500,000 becomes $1.7 million. So it's really no wonder nobody batted an eye at the taxation. They were attacking the rich, the upper 25%. And who could argue with 1% and, you know, maybe another 6% if you're really rich? The same tired ploy used by every other greedy, progressive, collectivist system of government. And unfortunately, the citizens were behaving just like the duped masses under those governments. And they let the federal government get away with it. Oh, by the way, 5 years later, people earning $1 million a year would be taxed 77%. And so began a long cycle of rates and loopholes and laws that have since devolved into the convoluted freak show that the tax system has become today. Once the government was given the right into people's wallets, the so-called progressive policies of the bureaucrats began to take root. They blatantly ignored the restraints put upon them by the Constitution and began to build upon their changed foundation of the federal government, taking away rights from people, sticking their collective noses into people's business, literally and figuratively, starting bureaucracies that were never meant to be done on the federal level. And the monstrosity we have today, the $17 trillion plus in debt, the $127 trillion plus in unfunded liabilities, the perpetual wars, the government's stalker-like need to know every little thing about you, all this and more can be traced back to the simple change in the American psyche that the government has some kind of right to take what you earn for yourself. But, if there's no taxes, then how will the government pay for... fill in the blank. And you hear some kind of variation of that question. And it's telling when people ask that. They can't seem to wrap their heads around the idea that personal income taxes aren't necessary. Maybe it's because the system has been in place for so long that people just don't know that there was once another way. Maybe it's because our current education system gleefully indoctrinates people into thinking it's the only way. Maybe it's because each generation continues to fall for the same silver-tongued promises of the power-hungry politicians. Government only needs these taxes because it has overstepped its bounds set by the Constitution. What happens if the government is no longer allowed to pilfer the incomes of its citizens? All of these failing systems will have to be reevaluated. People will have to ask themselves, is this really the government's responsibility? And if it's not really their responsibility, why are we giving them money to handle it, and handle it poorly? It would help to know what the federal government is supposed to handle. So let's look at what the Constitution tells us the federal government should be doing and ask ourselves how much they really need in taxes. I'm going to do these out of order to make some points. You may have heard where this is from, Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution. The responsibilities of the government to borrow money on the credit of the United States. To establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. How much in taxes needs to be collected to establish uniform laws on becoming citizens? If it wasn't so damn difficult now, we wouldn't have to spend so much on the bureaucracy and the force to keep people out who want to come in. No, streamline this, make it easy, and make it simple, so there's less bureaucracy needed and less taxes needed. And laws for bankruptcies? Why does any corporation have to worry about a bankruptcy if their cronies in the government are going to bail them out with taxpayer dollars? How about we get rid of this whole too-big-to-fail bullshit storyline, and if a company fails, you let it fail. And if somebody can't pay their debts, they work their ass off until their debt gets paid. To coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. To provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States. I wouldn't mind tax dollars being used to move the coining of money back into the hands of the federal government. That's where it should be. Preferably on the gold standard. Nor would I mind if the punishment for counterfeiting was applied to the Federal Reserve. But that's another podcast. To regulate commerce with foreign nations, and among the several states, and with the Indian tribes. I can understand the regulation of commerce with foreign nations, just don't get so greedy that you contribute to the destruction of our economy like you did prior to the Great Depression. To promote the progress of science and useful arts, by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. Copyright law for writings and discoveries. Yes, I can see a need to help protect intellectual property, but that's a debate for another time. To establish post offices and post roads. Actually, I would remove this, as private companies have proven to do a better job without having to take billions of taxpayer dollars in order to make up for their losses because they don't charge the proper market price for their product. Sorry, USPS. I don't think we need you anymore. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by secession of particular states, and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state, in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings, and to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States, or in any department or officer thereof. Okay, so we've got Washington, D.C. already. We've got an area for the federal government. Let's move on, because now we're getting to the big stuff. To constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations. A court system to protect the citizens from fraud and force. Yes, I can get behind that, so long as the justice is blind and fair. To declare war, grant letters of mark and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. Where have I heard this one before? To raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. To provide and maintain a navy. To make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Just like the court system is a necessary function of government to protect citizens from force and fraud of the bad guys in our midst, so too is the protection of the citizens from outside forces. But that's the key, isn't it? The idea is to have a military to defend the nation, not go on the offensive and try to start wars across the planet. Get our troops out of these clusterfucks we've created for ourselves. But that's only the beginning. We have bases all over the world. Many of those countries don't want us there. Fine. We'll pull out everything of value and tell them they can now defend themselves. If they still want a United States presence there, they're going to have to pay for it. No more defending other nations on the American taxpayer dime. Then, we stop going to war unless it's done constitutionally. Then, we stop going to war with ourselves. The war on drugs, the war on poverty, the war on fill in the blank. Enough is enough. These foolish policies of the federal government are failures. They have caused as many problems as they have purported to solve. It's an unnecessary waste that does nothing more than gives government the illusion of accomplishment. After all is said and done, how much does the government really need? If we cut back the federal government to be limited to its constitutional duties, we impose a flat tax for one purpose and one purpose only, to pay off the trillions of dollars in debt that we have, and leave all the rest to be dealt with by each state or by the care of its citizens, then we will really see who and what needs our money, and who and what is just bilking us. Take away the crutch, and you'll see who really needs it. One caveat on the flat tax. One loophole, if you will. The date it is implemented, it should not apply to anyone who was under the age of 18 prior to the last election. Those people did not have the chance to change things, so they should not be punished with paying off the debt. So, we end the abomination that the federal government bureaucracy has become. We turn over to the states the responsibility for all unconstitutional programs currently undertaken by the federal government. The federal government then is only responsible for those items listed in Article 1, Section 8. We only go to war if the Constitution is followed. And we have a tax for the sole purpose of paying off the debt, a tax that will be repealed once the debt is paid off. It will take many years to do so. But once we do, our country will be back to that shining example it once was. The idea may seem crazy. It may seem impossible. But the only reason it seems that way is because of the generational brainwashing that has convinced us the path to prosperity is the sorry path we currently tread. It's wrong. It's an illusion. Its end is the slaughterhouse, and we are meant to be the cattle. There's a reason why I believe this will work. For the first 125 years of the United States' existence, it did work. This is not a blueprint for utopia, like the collectivists claim their schemes to be. No, under the idea I advocate, there will still be rich and poor, winners and losers. There will still be homeless and income disparity. Why? Because that happens no matter what. But there will be more opportunity. People will have a better chance of pursuing their dreams, with less red tape restraining the system. The cost of living will become easier. You won't have to stress over taxes or have the government auditing you. It will necessitate people focus more on building a full life for themselves rather than expecting a bureaucracy to do it for them. No, it will not be easy. The best things in life rarely are, but it will be worth it. If for no other reason than to know that you take back and are fully responsible for what belongs to you. One of the basic ideas libertarians hold is the right of ownership. Set aside all the things you commonly think of that you may own: cars, houses, televisions, books, rhinoceros figurines, and consider this. If nothing else, you at least own yourself. Your body is yours and nobody else's, unless you choose to relinquish or cede that of your own free will. This is why libertarians believe, for example, you should be able to do drugs if you want, because it's your choice to do with your body as you please. Now, take that idea and expand on it from there. If your body is yours, then what you produce with your body is yours as well. No, I don't mean what you produce after you eat a sardine and avocado sandwich. Don't be gross. I mean what you produce with your intelligence and your effort. Your work. That is yours. You chose to trade your intelligence and effort for money through work. Money is the middleman of trade. You then take that money to procure for yourself things that you need and you want. If you want to give some of that money to charity for a cause you believe in, then you should be allowed to do so. If you wish to keep every single penny you earn for yourself, then you should be allowed to do so. That is the libertarian philosophy. You have what is yours. You are not entitled to other people's money. They get to keep what they earn as well. You're entitled to yours, what you have earned. If you're walking down the street and a man walks up to you and points a gun at your face and demands you give him all the money in your possession, you would consider him a thief. Why? Because he's taking what doesn't belong to him. What if he's desperate and he needs to feed his hungry children? Doesn't matter. It's still robbery because he is using force. But what if it's a smiling man in a nice suit and he's only forcing you to give up, say, 1/4 of the money you have on you? What if he's not holding a gun? But he tells you that if you don't give him what he demands, he will show up at your doorstep because he knows where you live. And he'll show up with people who do have guns and will not only take what he wishes, but throw you in jail as well. What if this man is taking the money from you because he believes he is entitled to it? Because he believes he knows better how to spend what you earn. That is the essence of the federal government's personal income tax. If you don't pay what the government thinks you should pay, they'll come after you. They'll intimidate you. They'll make your life a living hell. Eventually, they will bring people with guns, the police, to arrest you and or put you on trial, where you are guilty until proven innocent. Do you see yet why I believe the 16th Amendment is the worst thing that ever happened to this country? Do you see yet why I believe a personal income tax and the bureaucracy that has been created to enforce it is un-American? It is only amplified by the fact that the pre-1913 method of tariffs and excises would be enough to run the federal government if the federal government was adhering to the Constitution rather than taking away the rights of the states and the rights of the people. It doesn't have to be that way. We don't have to be shackled by a century of mindless habit. We don't have to be swept away by a myopic collective that can't see past one horrible amendment. We can be a brave new nation once again. We can step into the chaos of an unfettered market championed by the notion that what I make is mine and what you make is yours. We can break away from the herd mentality of the OPM collective. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.